Yay! Nope. Didn't write a joke for this part. Yes, I did. All right. Hong Kong. Not OJ, though. In honor of I, Tanya, what's a 90s news item that should be a movie?
I'm Katie Rich, and I'm going with the ascendancy of Jesse Camp on MTV's I Want to Be a VJ contest, because I see it as like a Wolf of Wall Street style, kind of like coked out look at this crazy heyday of a almost bygone era. And then Dave Holmes survived the whole thing somehow. He can probably write it.
I am Matt Patches, and I'm going to go with, I just remember in the 90s, a lot of kids talking about the Lorena Bobbitt trial, cutting off the penis whole shebang.
Why would we talk about that?
I don't know.
As children in the 90s.
Why were we laughing about that horrific act of cutting off a man's wiener?
Said wiener. That's why.
Just way to explain my joke. Anyway, the Lorena Bobbitt trial.
Hey, it's me, David the Seven, and I don't want a jingle all the way comedy, but I do want a drama movie about the Tickle Me Elmo craze of 1996.
I'm David Ehrlich. I was going to go with Lorena Bobbitt until Patches stole it out from my trousers. But I will default to the most important and glorious incident of the 90s, which was the New York Rangers 1994 Cup run, of course. Already covered somewhat
I'm
in
asleep.
A 30 for 30 documentary.
Miracle on Ice 2, as they say, I'm sure.
Miracle or on Ice. The 30 for 30 documentary about O.J. Simpson and the Rangers victory parade and the Knicks game and all that stuff. But we could just watch it. Mark Messier could be the lead character. We could just watch something about the Rangers Cup run. I'd cry every time.
Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
Fine, I can hear you now, Dimitri. Clear and plain and coming through fine. I'm coming through fine too, eh? Good. Then, as you say, we're both coming through fine. Good. Well, it's good that you're fine and I'm fine. I agree with you. It's great to be fine.
It's a podcast. Hello and welcome to Fighting in the War Room. It's episode 193, and it's Tuesday, December 5th, and on this day in 1974, the final episode of Monty Python's Flying Circus aired on BBC TV, and probably, a year later in the U.S.? Isn't that how that worked back then?
Bum, 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 bum.
Dave sings TV theme songs is like my favorite subplot of this entire podcast. It's what brightens my days. Before we get started, apparently we have a lot of ratings on iTunes, which we appreciate as always, but we're still in need of reviews. So maybe the thing to do if you've left us a review is to talk to your friend who is listening and hasn't left us one. Just put on some solid peer pressure for the holidays.
Don't talk to them about anything. Talk to them about this.
Yeah, only this. You know? Whatever's going on in their actual life. This is more important, obviously.
Be like, you know how the news makes you want to scream into pillows, Mom? Well, take this nice, film podcast and wrap it around you like a warm blanket. They'll only occasionally let the bad things in, but just with, little side jokes.
Yeah. Nuclear war and side jokes.
We did have somebody write on fightinginthewarroom.com and respond to one of our topics from last week. I could read that.
Sure.
Okay. So last week we talked about the R rating for Lady Bird and kind of the R rating for Call Me By Your Name, which we were outraged by. And on fightinginthewarroom.com, where you can leave comments and listen to the episodes, of course, our listener Caleb wrote this. I believe the situation regarding theaters letting underage kids into R and NC-17 rated fare has more to do with NATO, not that NATO, the National Association of Theater Owners, more than the MPAA. From what I understand, theaters with ties to NATO can get in trouble with the organization if they are caught selling tickets and letting underage kids into those films. Having worked at 4 movie theaters, all fairly small and indie, I've only ever had to conform to those rules at the theater I worked at that was on a military base. Whoa! I don't really know what NATO would do if they caught theater employees violating the rule either. I do know the small indie theater I work at now in New Hampshire doesn't give a shit. I've even asked my supervisors. I haven't ID'd anyone for a movie in the 14 months I've been there. Noble!
Teens of New Hampshire,
awesome.
Get going.
Flock
to this theater.
To New Hampshire. don't see Lady Bird illegally on a military base, apparently. That's
scary. No, you can get court-martialed for that, probably.
Well, so that was really interesting. Thank you for leaving that on fightinginthewarroom.com, an alternative to our normal reviews. It's not quite five stars. I don't know. There's no button to tell me if this was helpful or not.
But I found it helpful.
Or David to tell me if it was.
But I found it helpful.
It was insightful.
But we'll never be able to quantify that. So
true.
What's
yeah.
the point?
It's the dream.
So out in theaters now in extremely limited release and presumably making its way around the country throughout December, like so many other movies that are out right now, is Guillermo del Toro's The Shape of Water, which premiered at the Venice Film Festival and won like the huge top prize, which got people talking about it constantly in this huge way. And it feels to me like since the Critics Awards have started coming out, which we'll talk about later, it's like there's a little less attention being paid to it, which I think is maybe a good thing for a movie like this. It's a big and ambitious movie. It's it's set in Baltimore in the 1960s. It's about a love story between a human woman, played by Sally Hawkins, and an aquatic fish man creature, who's played by Doug Jones, who's played like 100 different Guillermo del Toro creatures. And it's a fairy tale. It's very, it's explicitly established as such. And it's kind of like this, it's a nice movie that it also has a ton of violence and monsters in it, which is an interesting combination, and for Guillermo del Toro kind of makes sense. But I feel like I've been able to feel more affectionate toward it since it stopped being like the movie that everyone tells you if you didn't weep through the whole thing, you were dead inside. Patches, you saw it much more recently, right?
Yeah, but I'm now I'm like aghast. Who would say that to you?
Well, I don't know. No one told me that if I didn't cry, I was dead inside. But people had really intense emotional reactions to this movie when it first started
screening.
Interesting.
Well, I don't usually get that way about movies, but I thought this movie was incredibly sweet. It's very surface level. It's very fairy tale like. As you said, it's almost a kid's movie, except for the fact that like in the first 5 minutes, Sally Hawkins is masturbating in her bathtub, and then later there's some horrific violence. And yeah. I was recalling that kind of juxtaposition in Pan's Labyrinth, where it's from the eyes of a child and like the kind of an Alice in Wonderland falling down the rabbit hole, but then you have someone ripping open their cheek and just blood gushing everywhere. And actually, I don't know what Guillermo del Toro's hang-up is about cheek violence, but there's some of that in Shape of Water as well.
Ooh,
not to spoil too much, but it's a bizarre hang-up for him. It can be quite shocking at times, so I don't know if this is a movie for kids, but it's definitely to be transportive in that way for adults. I think it's really supposed to be whimsical and picture book like, and it certainly is. I mean, it's a gorgeous movie. The cinematography, every frame is quite striking, and the colors, and of course Guillermo del Toro's usual practical special effects. All the merman stuff is rendered in very practical effects. And I don't know. I was taken by it, but I don't find it to be a very emotional experience. Perhaps something I felt in a lot of Guillermo del Toro's movies. I don't get sucked up into his blockbuster stuff. I'm not on the Blade 2 train like many people are, and I'm certainly not into Pacific Rim. Yeah, Crimson Peak. It was like touring an amazing haunted house. I loved the mood. I loved the throwbacks in terms of his love for Gothic cinema, the Hammer stuff, like everything that's being injected to that, and kind of touring around this place and touring around this world. But I wasn't really like struck by the story. And Shape of Water, in a way, I think the emotional bent of it is really Sally Hawkins. I don't think Guillermo del Toro's filmmaking necessarily draws me into an emotional story, but Sally Hawkins is, I really think, one of the best performers that we have today. She was in another movie that no one saw this year called Maudie. Did anyone see the movie? Oh, come on. I thought it was lovely. And again, it's Sally Hawkins, and in that she plays a painter. And again, she can do anything. I really believe she's one of the best actresses we have, and can take something groan-worthy, in David's opinion, and make it quite spectacular.
And she is definitely a highlight in that film, but that film is a fucking eyesore.
Boo! I mean, it is kind of an eyesore. I'll give you that. It's a muddy Canadian drama or whatever. But
oh, those Canadians. They love their mud.
Yeah, why you got to bring Canada into this? It's just not a good film.
David, you've been kind of down on Shape of Water as we've been preparing to talk about this. Did you like it when you first saw it and then it faded for you?
No,
or have you always been kind of iffy?
No, I was iffy on it from the start. I think, unfortunately, I got to it a whopping like 48 hours after it had its rave debut in Venice. I saw it at Telluride, but I think like every Guillermo del Toro movie, it just does not emotionally connect for me at all. It does not come together in the slightest way. It's a million disparate parts, all of which, you know, can feel him sketching out in his notebook, chasing certain visions and ideas. None of them congeal in ways that I find meaningful. I understand and appreciate how this film could be seen as a testament to the other and feeling like an outsider and so on, but that's not enough. I mean, you can't just give lip service to those ideas, which this movie does, and none of its individual parts work strongly. You don't commit to any particular one of them. I mean, there's this great, potentially great bit where Sally Hawkins, who is wonderful in this, as she is in everything, finds her fish man watching a movie in the theater underneath her apartment, and the scene cuts away as soon as Sally Hawkins enters there and finds him. And I thought that was so typical of a movie that just doesn't really know what it wants to be about. There's a ludicrous subplot involving Michael Stuhlbarg and Michael Shannon. Michael Shannon, his performance is the most boring thing I've seen on a screen this year.
Wait, more so boring than him in Nocturnal Animals, which was another
that was last year.
Yeah,
therefore being semantic. I'm just, yeah.
Like, Michael Shannon keeps getting acclaim for his like worst
more
performances.
More boring than his performance in Potterville, in which he plays, or Pottersville, whatever the fuck, in which he plays a man who pretends to be Bigfoot in order to draw attention to his dying.
I mean,
upper,
that sounds interesting. So
yeah, no, that sounds insane.
And also he's married to Christina Hendricks, who's a furry, but that's neither here nor there. But he is just playing his typical garden variety Michael Shannon sociopath here. Every second he was on screen, I was just like, why am I watching this? Why am I not spending any one of these precious minutes on one of the more interesting things that's happening in this film? It felt very short. I don't know. It just never felt like there was time for any of this stuff to grow emotionally. It's very similar to Pan's Labyrinth in that they sort of lay out the fairy tale rubric for it all at the very beginning and circle back to it at the end. And I didn't feel any sort of growth from one to the other. I felt this movie was totally flat. It looks beautiful. It's nicely acted aside from Michael Shannon, who's coasting and poorly cast as himself. But I felt nothing. And the sooner this movie goes away, the better.
What's interesting is that, I mean, Katie, I'd be interested to hear what you think about this, that, you know, you have this female character who can't speak and sexuality plays a very big role in her life. I mean, the first thing we see her do, as we said, she's masturbating in the tub and like making eggs and going to work. And then she has this routine, like every day she's masturbating. And I'm curious what her sexuality really has to do with this movie. Does it feel like an awakening? Does it feel like this is me? Is it discovering one's true identity?
Are you quoting The Greatest Showman intentionally?
No. This Jesus, what did me. I do? What did I say? Oh, no.
This is me.
Oh, God. No, I was not doing that. Oh, God. Stop. Stop.
I'm not scared. I'm be brave.
You know way more of the words of that than I do,
this
David.
This is me. I'm seeing it on Sunday, and I am amped.
I'm not going to get ironic pleasure out of seeing that movie. Godspeed. But to get back on point, you know, you have Sally Hawkins. She's falling in love. You have Richard Jenkins, who is a gay man trying to find some connection in this world. It's a lot about sexuality, but is it at all? Like, in the end, I mean, I don't know what this movie's really about, and which didn't take too much away from my enjoyment of it. It's, again, a simple story, a romance. She gets to fantasize about, like, being in La La Land at some point, dancing with a merman. And
I mean,
it's a dream, but what's it about? I don't know.
I think the fact that it's frank about sexuality doesn't mean that it has to be about it. Like, I think, you know, it embraces her as a person who has sex to make it from the very beginning. Like, you can't imagine this chase romance between her and the merman. Like, you know that they are going to actually have sex. And it's kind of interesting in that it's transgressive. Like, you see Guillermo del Toro, who loves his monster movies, like, really liking the idea of going through with it and, like, explaining how it would really happen. I mean, I think it's about, like, love that is not seen as authentic by society. I mean, people have seen it as like a metaphor for being in the closet, which I think Richard Jenkins' character really brings forward. Guillermo del Toro has said it's about like the idea that immigrants are not considered actual people and that their relationships aren't real. I mean, it's, I think what makes it powerful for people is that it's like a lot of fairy tales. It can mean a lot of different things to different people. And I don't think that is what makes the movie flawed for me. Like, I think it's specific enough about what it's doing with its characters, but I also felt emotionally disconnected from it in a way that I'm relieved to hear it wasn't just me.
Can I just jump in and say one thing? They do explain how Sally Hawkins and the Merman have sex. There's like a 1 minute bit about how his penis comes out, and it's dawning on me now that it's just like the Reaper's mouths in Blade 2.
Yes.
It's such a Guillermo del Toro without actually seeing it. It's so weird. But yeah,
it's one of those things where I find everything that Katie was saying about what the film is about, I think Patrick is saying some of this as well, is beautiful and spot on. And I am all about championing movies that bring these ideas to the fore. And you know, despite my brashness a little bit earlier in this segment, the world is probably a better place when people like Guillermo del Toro are free to make. I mean, this was not an easy film for him to make, unfortunately. The industry is not particularly amenable to filmmakers like him these days, but he was able to make it. I think it's great for the world that that sort of movie is out there at this budget level and is being seen and so on. Even though it's a lot cheaper than it looks. It's only budgeted like $15 million or something like that.
That's crazy.
The beauty of its ideas, and this is true of all of Guillermo del Toro's films for me, is that I love so much about what they want to be, but I can't love what they ultimately are. It just, it's all of this, these whims of the world, this gothic fantasia of ideas that just don't belong to, they don't really service one another in a meaningful way, or they get tripped up with other things. And I'm always right at the doorstep, except for Pacific Rim, which is a fucking atrocity. But otherwise, I'm always like right on the doorstep of falling for these movies, and I just can't get over the threshold. And over time, I mean, this is the rare example where we see it ballied around in award season, and that is obviously going to make me, just as human nature, a little bit less disposed to liking the film. But it's frustrating that I can't quite get over the hump. I'd like to watch the movie again. I have a screener of it. Maybe I will. But
I will say I was happy to watch it on a rainy day. That made it very special to me.
And it's a very cozy movie.
I did watch it on screener in my house, like on my couch, and that made me happy on a rainy day, as opposed to like going to AMC and being blasted with 20 minutes of ads or whatever. But
I'm a prick. The Olaf short.
Oh yeah,
yeah. They put that
which is now playing in front
now,
of everything.
Right?
Justice for Olaf, bring it back.
I was very glad when I put in my Coco screener and the Olaf short was not on it. Although
that's
now
sad.
I'm curious.
I had to go see it in theaters and see that goddamn short.
It's not even in the short list for the short Oscar animated this year.
What is so horrible about it? I literally don't even know.
Okay, I could really quickly sum up what's horrible
about
it.
For one thing, it's 21 minutes long.
Yeah, that's crazy.
That's number one. Number two, there are 3 to 4 songs in it. I'm going to count the fourth one as like the callback on all of them. Two of them make use of the fact that they ring this thing called the Yule Bell to like ring in the season, literally. And the kingdom's name rhymes. It's like Rivendell something. Arendelle. They use that rhyme 4 times. I was like dragging my face against like, gonna ring the Yule Bell. Ring it over, Arendelle. I'm like, fuck you. And then the whole thing is like, the sisters don't have like a Christmas tradition, and they're the only people in the town that don't have a Christmas tradition. And Olaf goes out to find them a tradition, and then it turns out at the end they're like, "No, our tradition was like making a snowman." I'm like, "There's a fucking song about that in the first movie. How did you forget about it? Why did we have to 21 minutes? You figured it out? Oh my god! Anyway, there's nothing good about it. It's horrible.
Can we put this in the show? That was amazing.
This is definitely in the show. This is the end of Shape of Water. Maybe see Shape of Water. Don't see Olaf's silly adventure.
I sway in place to a slow disco and a class for the saints and a bow for the bold.
So we're recording this episode, and it will be the last that you hear before anyone knows anything about Star Wars. The press screenings will be next week. Dave is going to the premiere. Are we allowed to say you're going to the premiere? Is that...
Hopefully that didn't screw it up for me right there. But I'll be in Los Angeles trying to get into the premiere one way or the other.
So this is kind of the fun period where it could be anything and it could be great. I do miss 2 years ago when Patches was trying not to know a single thing about Star Wars, and it was like an espionage effort to try to keep it away from him. but so Dave, like, other than like plot things or like any spoilers that I don't really want to know, like, what are we hoping for out of Last Jedi? Like, for people who really pay attention to Star Wars, like, are we getting like Empire Strikes Back level expectations? Like, is everyone just in love with porgs and leaving it at that?
Ugh. I think there's a lot of porgs. Okay, in terms of
stop saying porgs,
please. Porgs, a lot of porgs.
No more.
There's going to be a lot of porgs for forever. They're the new Ewoks, but we were recycling through them so much faster. What we want from this is what audiences tend to want from this is, if you're a really diehard Star Wars fan that enjoys the fact that Star Wars is back, but maybe thought The Force Awakens was derivative or too popcorny, or you didn't like Rey, or you're bitching about something, you're looking for Rian Johnson to really put a pivot in what we consider a Star Wars story to be. And all indications are that at least Disney thinks that he's come across that. He got through the process without being fucked with, at least as far as we know. And he's one of the few directors to do that, depending on how much
he's
a great
J.J.
Abrams.
Director, you know?
Yeah, was it?
Jesus.
And then he's been given the reins to come up with the plot for a new trilogy of Star Wars movies without us seeing this one. So obviously Disney thinks they have something good. They want to pivot around the main characters that they've reintroduced as a franchise, because as they've learned with Carrie Fisher after they were done shooting, the original stars aren't going to be around.
They are mortal.
For very long. They are mortal, both in the story and in real life. Apparently, though, all of Carrie Fisher's sequences and scenes made it in unaltered. So everything they shot with her is how it appears in the movie. There wasn't anything that was rejiggered to do anything to Leia's story one way or the other.
And so we don't know. It's presumably they will kill her off in the next movie.
Presumably that is J.J. Abrams' problem one way or the other. But otherwise, we're looking for, you know, it's going to be fun to hear Luke Skywalker say something finally after all these years.
In the most worrying part of the trailers, and I have every confidence that this is like the original trilogy. It's going to continue following in the original trilogy's footsteps. This is going to be The Empire Strikes Back, Redux. It's going to be the best of the three films in this trilogy, and so on. However, every line that Luke Skywalker delivers in the trailer made me cringe.
It's an interesting development.
The Joker voice was a choice. Did not see it coming.
No, it's going to be interesting to see what that character does, because at one hand, you're going to want to see the Luke Skywalker you always wanted to see.
One hand? Was that like a Buster Bluth joke?
Ayo, hey. And then I got to make more seal jokes, space seal jokes. But on the other hand, the title would seem to indicate, and the trailers would seem to indicate, that this is not the Luke Skywalker everyone was expecting. So it's going to be interesting to see what Mark Hamill does. I'm not as pessimistic about it as David is, mostly because I think he has so much latitude in what we will accept as Luke Skywalker, both because The Force Awakens was successful and because he is who he is as a public figure. That being said, I'm interested to see what the bros are up to. I think Rey's going to have a great story one way or the other, but I'm interested to see if Finn's little spy mission with Rose, our Asian Star Wars lead, first Asian Star Wars lead, they're going to head off and do some fun stuff together on a team, and Oscar Isaac and Laura Dern are going to kind of butt some political heads. So I'm looking forward to all those team-ups.
I'm with you. More Poe. I think that's what Force Awakens dropped the ball on the most. Poe was cool, but Poe did nothing in The Force Awakens.
Yeah, he wasn't around much.
He needs more Poe. He needs a character. He needs a motivation. He needs an arc. Give us some Poe.
Dave, are you... I mean, I think your tolerance for this sort of thing is a lot higher than mine, but are you at all worried about Snoke?
Am I at all worried about Snoke? No, I think he's the way into pushing beyond this trilogy. So my hope is that he stays much like the Emperor was in the original trilogy, where he's just the big bad guy, and we don't... Like, I hope that who's Rey's parents are as much backstory as we care about. We're all in the four story. Conflict is Kylo Ren and Rey.
You know that Snoke sucks, right? Like, you're aware of this?
Snoke like is great!
From the previous film, at least.
I mean, I guess... I don't know what you mean by sucks, man. If we're following the, you know, first you see him in hologram, then you see him in person, and then he dies. That seems to be the way evil monarchs go.
The three cycles of life.
I mean, every time there's, like, a bad CGI motion capture face, I always look at that one shot that they've released of real Snoke from the trailer, and he has like skin texture and he has like eyebrow hairs, and you know, he's not a human, but that's beneficial for the Uncanny Valley, so I'm still on its side until otherwise.
Why,
if you're gonna try something that weird, why isn't he a human?
Why make him a human?
Why make him
Do you
want
to know the real answer to that?
All the CG looks so bad. The original Emperor, he was a human. He was a little fucked up, but
he was melty.
A face makeup on. The push of all of Star Wars is to get out of everything that we know. So Snoke's origin is from beyond what we know is like known space. Tatooine used to be the outer rim, but now we're going to push into what we're called the unknown regions. And the whole reason that's been very obvious is that's where the new Disneyland Star Wars land is set. That's where the books are all saying everybody, all the new characters came from. That's where Thrawn came from. That's where Snoke came from. That's where the First Order came from. And they keep hinting that Rian Johnson's trilogy is going to be new characters and new locations. And the only way to do that, because the Star Wars universe is so expansive, is to go elsewhere. So Snoke is actually your window out of the Star Wars universe in the future, David.
Well, why does Rian Johnson need Snoke if he's just going to start from scratch?
I mean, I don't think he does. I'm just saying that Snoke is one of the many indicators pointing that in order for Disney to move on into making more Star Wars money but not have to rely on George Lucas and the original stars and having everything be based off a McQuarrie drawing, because eventually we're going to run the fuck out of those. Like, they're going to have to pivot hard, and they're not going to fuck with stormtroopers, and they're not going to fuck with Darth Vader. The extent that they wanted to do that was Kylo Ren. Whatever's coming next is going to be big. So I'm very interested to see The Last Jedi begin the process of differentiating what's old Star Wars and what's new Star Wars. Like, I don't want to see another fucking Death Star. They got away with that trick by goodwill.
There wasn't a Death Star in the last one. It was a Star Killer base. Okay, it's different.
You know what I mean. I want to see some variants. George Lucas got away with it by saying it echoed or it rhymed like a poem. Much like you, Patches, George Lucas liked to get away with things by saying they were poems.
Snoke's a poem, Star Wars is a poem, everything's a poem.
But I'm hoping that Star Wars could break out of that, and I'm interested. I'm watching all the old Rian Johnson movies to prepare this week. All three of them.
Yeah.
Like Fly.
And, I'm hoping for something different.
Dis. All right, moving on.
Go away from my window, leave at your own chosen speed. I'm not the one you want, babe. I'm not the one you need. You say you're looking for someone who's never.
So last weekend, So last week, David, you voted with the critics group in person in real life for the first time ever. This whole segment,
so much fun.
This segment isn't all about you, you were the one who kind of had a big milestone experience. So we wanted to talk about kind of the rash of critics groups that have been coming out. Patches and I voted in our group today as we record this, so we don't know what the nominees will be.
I voted in that group as well.
Are you wait really? You're in BFCA too?
I'm a double dipper, motherfucker.
Dang, you just get 18 copies of every screener just because they want to make sure they don't miss you?
I did get 2 copies of most screeners. It was a little bit excessive. My wife hates it.
Well, we have to wait and see if we're completely embarrassed by all the nominees that our peers have chosen, and we probably will be. Yeah. But David, so in the room at New York Film Critics Circle, it's like one. It's the first critics group to announce, except for the National Board of Review. It's kind of the first one out the door.
Which I also vote for.
Good Lord.
You're not supposed to be voting for that one.
Yeah, you're really not.
Yes, I am. They have no problem with me voting for them.
They would if they knew you were voting for it.
What do you mean?
I thought you aren't qualified to be in the NBR. I thought they would have a problem with journalists in there.
No.
Oh, well, then I retract my statement and say, go ahead and vote for the Post, you fool.
I did not vote for the Post. I mean, I did a top 10 ballot, and the Post was on my top 10 towards the lower end, but... I guess it had a general sentiment. Yeah, the New York Film Critics Circle is very secretive. I mean, I'm a new member, so I don't want to step out of line, but I get the impression that they like to keep things pretty close to the vest as opposed to, or chest, whatever the expression is, as opposed to the LA Film Critics Circle or Association, which is a lot more transparent about the decisions. They have ties, they have runners-up, they have people live-tweeting how close every category was, whereas I would feel like I was... betraying some sort of secret by saying what movies came close to what actors and actresses came close to winning what and how many rounds of voting certain awards took. So we don't talk about that with the New York Film Critics Circle, but I can say that it was a delight. And Katie, I'm happy to do a little gold menning with you about where things stand at the moment.
Well, I'm actually kind of curious and like in detail about your critics experience. And this is maybe inside baseball, but that's what this is for. Because when you're filling out your BFCA ballot, you're putting in your nominees, and then there will be a list of nominees, and then you will vote in your house. And there's like no table talk. There's no conversation. There's no sense of like seeing what the room is doing. And I think the way that the LA critics and the New York critics vote is really conducive to getting really interesting winners, like Tiffany Haddish for Girls Trip, or I think I don't have the LAFCA winners in front of me, but there's some good ones in there too. I mean, without giving away, like, wait, go ahead.
I'm
yeah.
allowed to say that voting for Tiffany Haddish was awesome. That was a real delight.
So, do you feel like that, having done it, is that the way that all these critics' awards should be voted on? Should we be finding ways to be in the room together because you're not just getting like a list in the ether of, you know, just what I like, and rather than trying to be like, all right, well, there's more people who are rallying behind Sam Rockwell, so I'm going to switch my vote from Michael Stuhlbarg so that I can help push somebody else over the line, or gaming it out.
It's not too dissimilar from the fact that I think is unfortunate about our podcast is that we don't get to record it together. And I do think that we lose a little spontaneity, there's a lot of like long monologues because we can't see who wants to talk and so on.
Who possibly could just do long monologues on this?
Yeah, I don't know if being in person would be able to help us in that department.
No, it would. It would. I think it would be more human doses. But I think it's sort of analogous to voting in these things because when you're voting at home for the BFCA online, I mean, you're really just running at the mouth and doing your own opinions. But when you're in a room with other people, you are getting the lay of the land. You are sensing what the sentiments of the room are. You get really involved in it. I think even if, like, I don't really care who wins the BFCA, I'm happy to be in the group. But, like, I don't feel like a personal claim necessarily over what wins. But when you're in a room with just 30-some-odd other people, and you're all there together, and you can see who is rooting for what films, it starts getting really – you get really into it. And that I think, definitely lends some fire to the whole thing, and it leads towards more – I mean, when you see something like Tiffany Haddish gaining steam, you really want to rally behind her. I mean, if you are a fan of her performance, which I was, it's a lot of fun, and definitely things can happen. If you do a round of voting and you see that one movie is faring – surprisingly well and has some momentum behind it. There was one actor, I will not say who, but in the first round of voting, there were only a couple of people who voted for him. And I think other people then entertained the idea of this actor being in contention. And the next round of voting, he had a much larger representation. And so you definitely have those pushes and pulls of being in the room that you don't get when you're just submitting a vote.
And there's something, like, what I like about Critics Awards, and I think this year, and I tweeted as much, I think, off of something you tweeted, David, that, like, there's so many good things that critics really like this year. There's a lot of affection to go around, and I like that, you know, we can obsess over, like, what's going to get a bigger Oscar boost from all these awards, but I just like that we are in a world in which Tiffany Haddish has an award, and Timothée Chalamet has an award, and, like, Willem Dafoe, and
Timothée
all these...
Chalamet has a lot of awards.
Okay, I mean, all right, I should come up with some... more of the obscure ones. But anyway, that everyone's kind of gets a chance to have their moment, and it's because of these conversations. And the Oscars aren't voted on in that way at all. Well, they're,
I mean, this is what happened
about at home
in LA with The Shape of Water. I mean, we may not be the biggest fans on the planet, but we had, no one had been really talking about the movie since the Venice win, and then all of a sudden you have the LA critics coming out and naming Sally Hawkins the best actress of the year, which now I'm wondering, like, maybe,
and, well,
you know,
and
that starts trickling down everywhere. Like, the effect is real. If the Critics' Choice voters start feeding off the New York and LA critics people, then you have people who are leading the conversation to the actual Oscars. Yeah. These are influential
but
moments.
Typically what happens is that you with critics want to be not contrarian necessarily, but they push back. The LA Film Critics vote, I would have to think, they know that we gave Lady Bird Best Picture, and they would know that elevating Lady Bird to that status on their end would be meaningful, because then you'd have the two most prominent critic groups both picking the same film. They, I think, feel freed to pick another film, and maybe are subconsciously leaning away from Lady Bird as a result of that, because they don't want to just be an echo chamber.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think that the experience of being in the same room, you do get over Oscar season, even though everybody votes from home, but you get that experience over the course of months, with people sort of everybody sort of watching the push and pull from afar, and then, you know, eventually favorites emerge and some people fall in line and some people don't. But I think the Oscar season is so long and so public that you do sort of get the same vibe, but just in, you know, by proxy.
Yeah, it's somebody winning a Golden Globe, not someone getting a surprising amount of votes in the first round. But it's the same sense being like, oh, so a bunch of other people like this performance too. So maybe I should go ahead and jump on it.
Exactly.
Now, to be fair, Katie, you said that we vote in isolation for
you,
the
for
Critics'
you and me,
Choice.
We've been swapping ballots back and forth.
Yeah, we spent an afternoon badgering each other, at least me badgering you, about trying to get the perfect votes. But other thing we talked about was, like, we don't have to vote. I mean, we can be a little crazier with our voting, because we at least want to get some different titles in there, because we're going to eventually vote based on nominees. So we might as well put some more daring votes. We might cast some more daring names into the pool, because, you know, we kind of expect certain people to win. So we can be strategic about our voting, which is why I was pushing Mudbound hard on you.
Yeah. I mean, I always get nervous about this, because I'm always worried, like, wait, but what if I don't put Saoirse Ronan on there? What if she doesn't get nominated? Because, like, all the people thought like I did and felt like they could go crazy. But the Barcast Film Critics Association is huge. It's over 300 people. And there's just, like, there's this, you know, there's enough people that the people who are big favorites in that way are just going to get in. So, like, I didn't put Timothée Chalamet on my Best Actor ballot so I could make room for Daniel Kaluuya for Get Out, because I thought he needed more of a push. I hope I don't regret it and that they both make it on there.
Every time I wanted to put Lady Bird, I put Columbus and Haley Lou Richardson instead. Sorry, Saoirse Ronan, but you've been replaced
in
my
heart. I
think
Saoirse Ronan,
she'll do fine.
I have to say, I just fucking love Saoirse Ronan. I was so excited to watch her on Saturday Night.
She was really
Live,
funny on Saturday Night Live.
I find her presence just so delightful. And she was hilarious.
Yeah.
I actually watched the entire fucking episode. I cannot remember the last time that happened.
Sometimes usually that will just kill your soul to watch the entire episode.
Yes. If you're in the territory past Weekend Update, you are truly in the deep end.
If you can survive Colin Jost and not immediately retreat to your bed.
But she is just, I mean, Brooklyn was not my favorite movie of that year. It's a lovely movie. It just didn't really crack the top 25 for me, but I thought she was wonderful in it. And she is just extraordinary as Lady Bird. And wish her all the best. Anyway, what were we talking about?
Were we all at that Hannah thing where she was like around talking to people?
She was there with her dad. Yeah.
Yeah.
I was at a, I met her and her mom on Monday. it was very awkward and brief. But
was it the Gotham Awards?
It'd be like, now I've met both your parents.
I did not remember her being there at the Hannah thing. I do remember talking to Joe Wright about like Tarkovsky or something, but
that's like the most stereotypical David sentence I've ever heard.
He brought it up. Thank you very much. Yes, it. She just seems lovely. I don't know. I'm a fan. I love that she's in this period of her career now where she's in like. I mean, this is not quite a trend yet. It's only been 2 years, but she's in like one movie a year. And both of their performances in them are phenomenal. And then we move on. I mean, she's in On Chesil Beach next year, which was at Toronto, and I hear wasn't super great. But and then she's in A Mary Queen of Scots movie, which I'll be excited to see. So that's cool.
Katie, let me ask you something. You, out of all of us, know the Oscars the best. So do the
thank you.
Do
I would
feel
take
like,
the badge of honor.
Yeah. Do you feel like these critics' awards are? Is there anything surprising? And does it like? Cut off anybody's run towards the best picture.
Is there anything
prize.
Surprising in what's been winning so far?
Yeah, well, the one thing that's actually come back to the thing that is surprising, because the first thing I want to mention was that I feel like you were beating the drum for Dunkirk for a long time, being like Dunkirk's definitely gonna win best picture, and now I'm like
means to an end.
I'm not so sure.
I'm not sure about that at all. I mean, the whole point was that was like a flashy way of getting into the idea that the makeup of the Oscars has changed and that the movies that would used to be shoo-ins for Best Picture are like we may be reaching this point where we have to rethink what the critic with the conventional wisdom is around these award shows. The makeup of the Academy is changing. The movies that are winning are consistently budgeted around $15 million and not these huge epics that we used to see.
Academy voters, right? I mean,
this is what my piece was about, though, when I was talking about Dunkirk. It was saying that in another year, a few years ago, conventional wisdom would have made this a prohibitive favorite, but now that's not necessarily the case. And so when I see a movie like The Post and I'm like, oh, this is a lock for Best Picture, which was my immediate thought. Because you can't really recondition some people of some things, I then have to take a step back and say, wait, we're living in a new world. I think it's entirely possible and would be awesome if something like Get Out won, if Lady Bird won, if Call Me By Your Name won. These smaller movies have a much, much better shot now than they ever used to.
Well, Katie, do you think that Dunkirk's chances are basically kaput when you don't have critics going after it? I mean, if the Academy has changed so much that it's hard to picture it as a winner in that voting group, and you don't see it in the critics, do you feel like that's just kind of...
See, I don't agree with David as much that the Academy has changed to the extent that Dunkirk couldn't win, because we don't really know how much the Academy has changed. Like, we know that they've added a ton of people and that they are, as a whole, a lot more diverse, but there's still a ton of old white guys in there. And I think the win of Moonlight tells us something, but not necessarily everything. And I want to say that Dunkirk, like, has the chance to come roaring back, and it does. Like, I think Christopher Nolan is there very much still in the running. Like,
many weeks...
Well, there's still many weeks, but like Dunkirk isn't going to really clean up on Golden Globe nominations. Like, it doesn't have actors to push it through, which is a real challenge. Like, it's not going to get SAG nominations. It's not going to be a big Globes. And then all of a sudden you're in the middle of January when the nominations are about to come out and people aren't talking about Dunkirk the way that they used to. I mean, and then you've got The Post, like David was mentioning, coming out as kind of this big studio movie that kind of, I think, can check that box as being, and especially if it's a hit by the time of voting. Yes.
You guys, I'm so sorry. You can include this on the show if you want. I just realized that I left my credit card at the draft house, and I realized that because somebody then tried to take it to the Target. It's connected to the draft house and spend $892.
Oh my God.
So I have to call Amex. Excuse me.
All right.
Is it Don Hertzfeld? Did he steal your credit card?
It's Don Hertzfeld.
He's financing World of Tomorrow 3.
Yeah, just do it, David, for the betterment of the world.
Yeah, I gotta go. I'll send my file in, Dave. Enjoy the rest of the talk.
All right, Dave. Yeah, all right. You're now David.
Yeah.
All right, so the thing is that it's like this horse race, and everybody's picking their critics' things, and we're all in a room, and that's great. And it's so much better than sitting at home, even if you're cheating, like Katie and Patches, because then
cheating. You
push forward a greater swath of performances, which is what you guys are trying to do by cheating.
But it's not cheating. It's
kind of there's cheating. No collusion, Dave. No collusion. Fake news.
Prove it.
No, even if there is, well, first of all, you guys just said there was collusion.
Just because you say something doesn't mean you really said it.
Fair enough. You could maybe your lawyer made all those statements.
When the president does it, it's not illegal.
unless it's Bill Clinton, and then it's a big
Hey-o.
Thing. Yeah, I don't know. That was interesting to hear about in the sense that I really want in on these conversations at some point. I'm just not sure exactly when I'm going to catch up.
I mean,
but at least from the outsider's perspective, it's interesting to watch you guys react as all the picks are coming out. Mm. That's always been my favorite time as someone who's very active on the film Twitter and looking more at like the breaking news. Is watching the critical reactions that happen to the Critics Awards sometimes tell me more, at least about people that I like and whose opinions I share, than the awards themselves.
It's like the breaking news Twitter, but it's not about horrible things happening in politics. It's about, I mean, it has been nice in the last few weeks to just be obsessing over movies kind of thoroughly as opposed to the news. I have found that a relief just professionally.
Yeah.
But Dave,
I think if people follow like your work or Patch's work or David's work, they're obviously used to living slightly ahead of their own release schedule.
Yeah.
So with that, it's especially good to have, like, it's not... No one's going to be talking about Call Me By Your Name like the second week of January necessarily with the same fervor they're talking about it now. But it is interesting to kind of get a centralized point amongst all the critics you like to, like, they all sort of weigh in and they all weigh in at once. And that's going to be when you get to engage with the most amount of critical voice with that movie. Hmm. Until it comes to you at some point.
But that's what I really like about award season, especially at this point, is that the conversation does keep going on. Like at the end of January, we probably will be talking about Call Me By Your Name to some extent in a way that doesn't happen in the rest of the year. You know, we talked about Wonder Woman for a good chunk of the summer and Get Out for a while, but like that was kind of it. Like for the most of the year, movies come out and then they're immediately gone. And award season, even though it lasts into March and I'm going to be exhausted by the end of it, like it allows you to have time to, like, where if you see, you know, Call Me By Your Name finally comes to your town and then you go to entertainmentweekly.com and it's there because it's won a SAG award or something like that. I like that aspect of award season.
Yeah, and movies, like, they have different, they pop at different moments too. I'm like, even looking at these critic awards, you know, the conversation's dominated by Call Me By Your Name and Get Out and Lady Bird, but we still have movies like The Post, whether you like it or not, or Phantom Thread, a movie that's like nowhere to be found in any of these critics' awards. And I'm not sure it's going to pop up too much in award season in general, despite having some magnificent performances, being a gorgeous movie. I don't even know how much I could technically talk about it. Everyone's putting it on their best of list, so I feel like the gates are down, but... It's a movie that's just not going to get award season love, and yet it will be injected into the conversations because people will hope it gets there. Does that make sense? That, like, it's not really part of, it's not realistically going to win Oscars, but it's always going to be part of it.
Isn't that just the opposite of the same enthusiasm that's going to keep Get Out in the running?
Right, exactly. That we just want to keep these movies going. I just feel like this conversation always gets bigger in January, as you were saying, Katie. Like last year, I felt like the most talk about La La Land or something like that was happening months after.
Yeah, and it's nice when like my mom can like watch the Globes and be like, what do you think about Moonlight? And then, you know, by then it's made its way to a theater that's accessible or like, you know, and some, you know, Get Out on but HBO Go right now.
This,
like,
year's
so
interesting.
Much time to catch up with these.
There's a lot more movie. There are many more movies, and I don't think there's like a front runner. So I'm wondering, what movies do you think are going to persist? Like, you've seen these critics, this first wave of critics awards. I was going to ask you about kind of surprises, things that popped out and that maybe people aren't talking a lot about and could kind of have this resurgence, at least in the awards conversation. But like, what movies do you think people are really going to be talking about in a month or two? Is it going to be just this trio, Call Me By Your Name and Get Out and Lady Bird? Are they really front runners? Or
I think front runners is a weird statement because this feels like a year where the Critics Awards and the actual Oscars picks might be really different. I think all three of them will definitely continue to be talked about until I think all of them will get some kind of Oscar nomination. They'll all be in there. I've been surprised by the extent to which the Florida Project is sticking in there. I really like that movie. I don't Yeah, I thought it was deserving of all of this, but like Sean
really
Baker winning
about
Best Director
on
yeah,
the podcast.
Have we not talked about it?
Let's take 1 minute to really talk about the Florida Project. All right.
Dave, have you seen Florida Project?
No, I've been trying to see it, but go ahead.
Patches, you don't want to talk about Florida Project.
Well, I guess I just wanted it's such an unassuming movie. I was really happy to see Sean Baker. Well, it's unassuming in that it has no stars. It's about this patch of Florida that people clearly don't care about because it's impoverished and overlooked by the tourists who flock there. So it's just not a quote unquote important story in some ways. I find it unassuming in that way. It's a slice of life, truly.
Yeah.
But it's gorgeous and it's naturalistic and it's so energetic but harrowing at the same time. This, again, you have this young girl, you know, running amok in Florida, and yet the reason she can do that is such a horrible reason. You know, her mother is prostituting herself, and she spends all her money on garbage food and booze and stuff, and she can't get her life together. And it's such an extreme, two extremes kind of clashing at this dingy motel. I don't know. I haven't read anything about how Sean Baker got this location, this purple castle, where he set the movie.
I don't know either. I mean, it's definitely like a real hotel in that real
strip. How did they take it all over? It's amazing.
Yeah, I don't know. I feel like I want to read that too. I mean, I like that you call it unassuming because you're right that it's about this like corner of the world that people don't look at. And Tangerine was the same thing. You know, it's about these prostitutes in Los Angeles, which is, you know, when the Oscars want to consider that or Hollywood people want to consider it, they look at it really differently. But it's made with all this craft, like it's, you know, shot on film and it, like, makes the most of all these sunsets that are happening out there. And it has these kind of audacious scenes that you feel like the level of improvisation that's happening with the kids, but it doesn't feel shaggy. It's like a really tightly constructed movie in the end. I love the Florida Project.
And to see it take off, the critics groups I can understand, but I do think it has the traction to be a Best Picture nominee with, you know, no stars. And even Moonlight had famous faces kind of sprinkled in. And I think I see a lot of people comparing Florida Project and Moonlight, I guess, because they both take place in Florida.
Sure, and they're released by A24. They're okay. Small indies.
They're colorful.
You
know, vibrant. Saturated colors.
I'll tell you one thing that has surprised me more is the prevalence of James Franco for Best Actor for The Disaster Artist. He won the Gotham Award.
I feel like
Award.
That's happening. I think he's going to get nominated for an Oscar.
I think he is too. And like, honestly, it's like less about the performance because he's really great in the movie. And it's, you know, weirder movies have been nominated for Oscars. But like, he fucked up the Oscars so bad 6 years ago. I really like... I don't know. Maybe they'll like decide at the last minute being like, nope, you can't come back.
No.
But it does feel like it's going to happen.
No way. Dave, did you see The Disaster Artist?
I did not. It is not open
until
this weekend.
I guess it just opened. It's slowly starting to expand.
Yeah, it did just open.
But that's a really weird movie, too, because, again, it's not like, quote-unquote, Oscar material. You know, this
well,
is a James Franco
talk about it, right? Because none of us saw The Room, but we're all going to see The Disaster Artist.
You've just let our dirty secret out. But we should all watch The Room.
The Room does seem like something you would have seen in college, Dave. I'm surprised by that.
It played around NYU
specifically
all
the time
of the
I
time.
Didn't see The Room. Because it was like, everybody's going. It's going to be real fun. It's good. And I'm like, eh. So good to know. But that being said, I could, you know, I'll take the art any way it comes. If The Disaster Artist's good, I'll watch The Room. And if The Room's good, maybe I'll read the book. That all sounds interesting to me.
Yeah, The Disaster Artist is like, I can't say it's a good time at the movies. It's a very frustrating, I had massive PTSD. I think maybe I mentioned this on the podcast
from your film production days.
From like film production days. I just like watching James Franco as Tommy screaming on set and acting like a madman. And just, I found it very disturbing. But he is he's very good in the movie. He just commits
really good in the movie.
To that accent, but he commits to the psychosis too. It's not just emulating Tommy Wiseau, it's like inhabiting the renegade spirit of this deranged man. It's pretty astonishing.
It's like that Jim Carrey Netflix documentary.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, actually. Which should also probably be nominated for an Oscar. I wonder.
That does it for this week's Fighting in the War Room. If you stole David Ehrlich's credit card, please bring it back to him. There's probably not that much money to be had. You'll get. We'll be back next week to talk about some amount of Star Wars. Probably there's going to be a lot of exciting stuff happening. In the meantime, tell the people who you are.
I'm Matt Patches. I'm the executive entertainment editor of Thrillist.com. I'm on Twitter at Mr. Patches. We have a website we mentioned at the top of the show, fightinginthewarroom.com. You can listen to the episodes. You can share them with friends who should be writing reviews of the show on iTunes, let's be honest. Or you can leave insightful comments about the topics we discuss, and we can read those, too, as we did with our old pal, Caleb. Thanks, Caleb.
Oh, yeah, and without David here, I go next. I'm Dave Gonzalez. You can find me on Twitter at DA7E. If it's Wednesday this week, the week before Star Wars, you should be able to find me in New York Times' online watching section, telling you all about the different things you need to know about Star Wars The Last Jedi, like, you know, what happened in The Force Awakens, what happened to Princess Leia in between Return of the Jedi and The Force Awakens, all those things. You can also find us, the podcast, on Facebook, where you could leave comments that we might also read if we run out of other comments to read. Is that the way that's the way things go?
Sure. I'm Katie Rich. You can find me at vanityfair.com, also on Twitter at Katie Rich, KateyRich. I'll be on Little Gold Men this week too, in person in New York. That'll be fun. You can also find all of us on Twitter at FITWR, where you can talk to us about whatever you want or answer this week's lightning round question, which was,
in honor of I, Tanya, what's a 90s news item that should be a movie? Do you guys know what New York Times retro news is?
No, but that sounds like a cool employee.
Well, I mean, they previously did a special of video shorts that was catching up on, like, little news items. Like the woman who sued McDonald's for getting hot coffee spilled on her. They do like a whole like 10 minutes about what that was and what's happened to them since. I don't know. I like Googling them. That's what this question reminded me of.
Did you say lightning room question?
Yeah.
You okay. did. I did. Yeah. All it right. happened.
Thanks for listening. We'll be back talking to you next week.